Connecticut. All the electronics and everything. Everything was, I think, pretty much done here. Gyros, everything. Let me drop it. Talking about a telescope. They want to launch a telescope. They call it the Brisson Telescope. It's going to be launched on a balloon. And it's called an acronym for Balloon Rapid Response. What they want to do is put a telescope up real fast to take pictures of this comet that we talked about maybe a month or two ago, the Ison comet, just an Oort cloud originating comet. Most comets come from the Kuiper Belt, which is on the ecliptic of all the planets. This thing could, you know, it's coming from the Oort cloud, so yeah, it could come from the ecliptic, but it could also come from the north or south or whatever. And this is one of those, you know, maybe it's coming by once every million years or so, instead of every 76 years like Halley, that would be a Kuiper comet. This is an Oort cloud comet. Let me drop it. It was discovered last September by some Russians. And in late November, it should be coming very close to the sun. Hopefully, it's a possibility this thing might not make it, you know, it might head to the sun, wind up going too close and actually burning up. But before that happens, they do want to get good pictures, they want to get infrared, they want to get ultraviolet, they want to get regular pictures of it. To do that, they really like to put up their own telescope. So the quickest way to do it is launch it from a balloon from New Mexico. And they definitely plan on doing that. They're going to launch it from Fort Sumner, New Mexico. And they'll probably do it around September or October, or before November. We drop it. The Ison comet will be investigated. If all holds true, this thing should be as bright, not as big, but as bright as the moon. Should be pretty impressive. So that's the latest prediction. They weren't too sure about that a couple of months ago. They thought it could be the comet of the century, but started to look like it probably will. I want to bring up that balloon mission. And one other topic is the Russian Progress resupply mission that was launched about a week or so ago. It did have an antenna problem. It didn't deploy its antenna properly. So what happened was they thought they have a problem. This is every time one of these goes up, it's got about 6,000 pounds worth of stuff on board. You know, I mean, it's got a couple thousand pounds of fuel, all kinds of oxygen, nitrogen, you know. Food, a lot of scientific supplies that they like to get there every couple of months from the Progress mission. And it almost didn't work. But they worked around it somehow. I haven't found out what they did. I noticed the antenna, they never did get that to release properly. These things are normally automatically docked to the space station. It turned out that's the way they eventually did it. So they must have some kind of backup system or something worked out properly. I don't know how they did it. I looked it up. Can't find an answer on it. Maybe after the weekend you get more information sometimes from NASA, Monday through Saturday. Saturday and Sunday, it's pretty hard to get that kind of information.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And I timed out. This is WS2N. So I want to bring that up. We've got a lot of missions coming up in the future. You've got an ATV, an automatic transfer vehicle, mission going up to the space station in June. You've got a moon mission. They're going to send a satellite to the moon to study the got like the Maven mission to Mars. A lot of space launches. That moon launch is actually going to be launched from Wallops Island, which is not too far from here, down in Virginia. And then the new spaceport that they've got pretty much built up or rebuilt. Not that it's new, it's been around since the 1940s, but new spaceport. They just launched the orbital science mission from there last week, about a week ago. The new Antares rocket, that went off successfully. And June, they'll probably launch another one, this time with the spacecraft on board called the Cygnus, bring that up to the International Space Station with supplies. All these missions that are up there, all the ones in the past, there's like thousands of them, and just try to keep track of them, and people wonder about what's going on. It's becoming almost impossible, so I just decided that maybe this is a good idea, Dick, to have people email me with either comments or questions. So I came up with a new email for this purpose called the spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. And maybe I could put together some information from people that might have questions. Some of the information that we look for, you just can't get, but I have a way of getting that with all the material I've collected over the last couple of decades. So I thought that might be a good idea, Dick. Back to net, WS2S. Great idea, Paul.
Fantastic. So Space Net Report, SpaceNetReport, all run together, no punctuation, at gmail.com. Is that correct, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, QSR will do that, and we'll see how that goes. And naturally, we'll look for the hams that, you know, want to know the questions. We'll take anybody. We're that way. Back to you, sir.
Now, let me find out exactly what you're volunteering here, Paul. People who have further questions and what they hear about the space portion of the TechNet, what NASA's doing, what is European Space Agency and the Japanese Space Agency and so on, what all these people are doing, what their individual missions are doing, how they're doing, what you'd like to know about them, and so on, a person emailing you at spacenetreport@gmail.com, you're really talking directly to WS2N when you do that, you're recommending that they send you questions and comments about what takes place on the net, or you volunteer even further, and maybe you don't want to do this, maybe we ought to make it clear. I presume you're not volunteering to answer each and every one of these questions privately, that you're going to collect these questions. If they're of a general nature, you'll bring them on the SpaceNet, is what John is doing. And I think John tries very hard to answer individually, although how far you take that, let me drop it. When I published those series of articles in QST magazine back in the dark ages of 1972, the article on the strip line, 432 megacycle, kilowatt amplifier, the 12-foot stressed parabolic dish, Houston, this is Apollo, the net result of all that is I was getting 350 letters per year. Each of those letters, in some cases, were 2, 3, and 4 pages worth of questions that they wanted answers. Some of them would give me a check or dollar bills in there where they wanted me to join their effort to design a satellite receiving system. And you heard about the guy who, in Mexico, married an American lady, moved her to Mexico, and she agreed to stay with him if and only if he can provide American television for her by way of a satellite TVRO. This is back in the late 80s when there wasn't anything like cable TV. So I'm supposed to join this effort to help him design the dish, the feed horn, the receiver, and whatever, with Mexican equipment, so that he can provide American television for his American lady in Mexico. And he mailed me a check on a Mexican bank to get the project going. That's just one eventually I developed the reputation of, hey, this guy RIW is not answering letters. He's a pretty snooty citizen. So how much are you volunteering here, Paul? And you can choose. WS2N, K2RIW, the tech man.
Oh, no problem. You know, we'll see how it goes, you know. You got one or two letters a week, that's no problem. We could do that on the air, preferably. But if it's 1 or 200, no, of course. Of course, I think. But what we can do is take a couple of the interesting ones that somebody might be wondering about it, and we'll bring it up on the on the net. I think that would be the best way to do it. And you know, you've got, like I said, countless missions. I spent a lot of time with the history of space, so, you know, past missions. How did, you know, what went on during Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, you know. How come the Gemini spacecraft didn't happen an abort system, you know, there was no way, if that thing blew up on a pad, they didn't have any tractor system to pull them away, or not even have, not even push a rocket. Questions like that were going to be answered probably on the net. If we could answer some of them directly, that would be okay, too. That's why I said, you know, primarily hams, what will happen is you get a bunch of emails. It sure is a lot easier to open up those emails if they have call letters behind them. You know, otherwise you wind up with spam and viruses and all that. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Question for Paul. Okay. I heard John and another person. We'll get to you in order. John first. Go ahead.
Dick, quick question for Paul. On the space shuttle, if at launch they had a problem, was that able to detach and take off and save the astronauts, or were they doomed?
The only ones that weren't toast was the first four flights of Columbia. When John Young and Griffin got in, first flight was only by two astronauts. They ran that test, and they really ran it full up. I mean, they never launched a space shuttle unmanned. They you know, ran tests on Enterprise. It landed. They dropped it from a B-52. Landed safely many, many times. But as far as launching it, now they just got in there, closed the doors, and hope for a four-day flight that was going to go well. But if there was a problem, if you look very closely at the first Columbia, there was right at the top doors that would blow off, and they had ejection seats for them. After the first four flights, that was gone. They took that all away. Back to you, John.
Okay. All right, good answer. Back to you, Dick. I think somebody else was waiting.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up that other person in a second. Paul, didn't the Challenger have a separate module that was supposed to disconnect that would be an escape mechanism for the astronauts? I think the Challenger had some kind of an escape mechanism, which I think was not built into the later space shuttles. Over to you, Paul.
No, there was no, when they went up on a solid, they had a little over 2 minutes for solids to separate. That was the most dangerous part of life. There was no way to do anything. After that, you had an abort system. There was a failure of one or two of the engines. Actually, if one failed, they usually could make it to Spain. Well, actually, they could abort to orbit, they used to call it. And then figure out what to do after that. But if they knew they had a problem, after the solid released, they could separate from the external tank that would have landed in the Atlantic, you know, the tank, and they would have come back and landed right at Kennedy on a 3 mile runway that they had built. So that would have been that would have been the abort system. After that, Challenger, they got involved. They had ways to open a door, had a pole that would fly out, and they'd actually slide out the side door, and one right after the other. But they, you know, had their spacesuits on, and they had some real exotic systems, but they did implement these things after Challenger.
And that sounds like a very difficult abort technique. Now, the other person who was assigned in, it sounded like Chris, KB2IQN, is that who I was hearing? Go right ahead, K2IW.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey, name him Joe.
Okay, Joe, Queen Yankee Whiskey, go right ahead, Joe.
I did that. Quick question. The new telescope, is that already built? It's like up and running? That was my question. And did you see that on a website, internet? Back to you.
Not quite sure what you're asking, Joe. When you say the new telescope, there's a lot of telescopes being built by European Southern Observatory in Chile. The United States is building a bunch of telescopes that are going to go on top of Hawaii. Mandalore, I think it's pronounced, but I'm not sure. I was talking about this 30-meter telescope that has just gotten approval to begin construction, and that construction hopefully will be completed by something like the year 2020. So when you say the new telescope, are we referring to a specific one that we supposedly mentioned tonight, Joe? KC2, QYW, K2LAW. Go ahead, Joe. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, hi, Dick. How you doing? The one that you mentioned, the 30-something, so I guess you said about 2020 it'll be done. That's the one I was talking about.
Yeah, from my point of view, that's the most exciting one right now, Joe. The 30-meter telescope. 30 meters, to go through the calculation, is 98 feet in diameter. And just to put that into context, Mount Palomar, which used to be the biggest piece of glass on planet Earth, was 200 inches, which is really 16 and two-thirds feet. So we're going to go from 16 feet to 98 feet diameter telescope, 30 meters. But it's not one piece of glass. It's 280 individual hexagonal-shaped things all held together on a frame. Each one can individually be tuned by way of a laser rangefinder, somewhat similar to the great big telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia. That one is 100 meters in diameter. 100 meters in diameter, 300 and some odd feet diameter, is this radio telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia. I was there during its construction. What a massive piece of hardware. Just the feed horn for that thing is something like 450 feet in the air. The feed horn in front of this fully steerable telescope. Let me drop. And that one's made out of something like 2,000 individual panels that are all tunable. So individual panels tunable is the modern way to go. You try to build a piece of glass bigger than 16 feet in diameter. There isn't a big enough vehicle in the world to move it. It's only going to take you 5 years to cool it off, and you hope it doesn't crack, and another 5 years to grind it. You know, it's a ridiculous project. That's for a 16-foot diameter Mount Palomar, 200-inch telescope. So this 98-foot diameter thing, it just got an approval from Hawaii. The Land Management Department of Hawaii said, we love this thing, build it. Here's a piece of land on top of the highest mountain we've got, one of the most desirable locations. And with modern technology, with these really fancy charge-coupled device detectors and adaptive optics that takes care of the scintillation of the atmosphere, it's going to make pictures that Hubble up till now. Let me drop it. The Hubble Space Telescope arguably is the best thing ever built. Makes the prettiest pictures. I mean, that ultra-deep field picture in space, where you take this tiny little chunk of wide. You aim the telescope there for a million seconds. That's a couple of weeks. And you take this picture, and you see 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before. To say that space is big and we ain't seen it all yet is the understatement of understatement. So some great hardware is on the way. So, yeah, I wish that that telescope was in operation now. And Paul and I are dreaming about what's going to be like in the year 2020 or 2021, whenever it's completed, the James Webb 2018. I mean, as an older guy, I'm worrying about now, if I eat just enough vegetables and lower my cholesterol just right, control my blood pressure just right, live long enough so I can see this thing in operation. I know it sounds crazy. I'm literally trying to stay healthy so I can see these pieces of hardware in operation, because I'm interested. I wonder if you sometimes think that way, Paul, or am I the only crazy person here? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, I do, Dick.
Okay, then you're not quite as crazy then. Go ahead, Paul, how do you think around these lines?
I gotta go sometime, but we'll ride it out as long as we can, you know? That's the way. I'm still waiting for the first man to land on Mars. Dick, if you ever want to read a good book, I don't know. This one, I really recommend, especially if you're slightly interested in the physics, what goes on if you're on Mars. Never mind getting to Mars, but if you're on Mars. Read the book, The Martian, Global Martian. A lot of books that come out with that name, but this one in particular is very, very good. You find you want to, but, What would happen if you were stranded there, and how you would survive, and what's involved in getting there, and what's involved in getting somebody to rescue? It's really a very well done book. Back to you, Dick.
Give me a break.
Good question, Dick.
John recognized, and here's the real question, Paul. I know I'm guessing you're a 60-some-odd-year-old person. If you were a young, virile, 22 years of age, interested in science, and you had the ability to go to Mars today. NASA's looking for volunteers. And either it's a one-way mission or a two-way mission, but you could get your body on Mars. Would you volunteer to do that, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, after I read this one book, The Martian, here it is, by Andy Weir. I want to do it at any age, but... Back when I was younger, sure. Sign me up. But not now. they've got this one group coming out of the Netherlands. Mars One, they call it. And they're signing people up for, you got to pay them all kinds of money. And they'll sign you up to send you to Mars. But you're not coming back. They're going to have four people at a time. This guy plans on doing this, I don't know, within the next 15, 20 years. I would highly recommend hanging on to your money. It sounds like this guy's, a cross between, to me, maybe one of these religious... fanatics that collect money. I can't believe it, but he's going to have people go to Mars and not come back, Dick. So I don't think I'm going to be one.
I'm reasonably sure with what I know about Mars, the coldest, driest, most unprotected place, no atmosphere, everything the sun issues, which is some tremendous blast of high power materials and whatever, the solar wind, those eruptions and ultraviolet rays and cosmic rays and everything else. I don't want to go there. If I was young and virile, I would turn it down. I know there's a certain number of people who definitely would. I'm pretty sure John would turn it down. KC2WGB, go ahead with your question, John. K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with the comment.
John first and then Glenn. Go ahead, John.
Look, definitely I would turn it down. Absolutely would not go. Even with return trip guaranteed, I wouldn't go. But anyway, I have a question. concerning the telescopes in Hawaii. Have you heard, or maybe Paul has heard, do they have or experience any problem with the tremendous amount of dust that's being spewed in the air by the volcanoes that surround those areas? Have you ever heard of any problems with that? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, back when that unpronounceable volcano in Reykjavik, Iceland, was blasting away a couple of years ago, and certain aircraft had to be canceled because they would jam up the engine if you flew through that volcanic dust in the atmosphere. I guarantee a lot of grief occurred along those lines. And with your great adaptive optics, you can't cancel the dust giving you obscured pictures. I don't think they're running into much of that problem. I'm going to turn it over to Paul for that one. And while you've got the platform here, Paul, tell us what you know about the dust problems with the Hawaii telescopes and with all the space material you've collected over the years. I've got to know whether or not you have some interest in unidentified flying objects. And there's many levels of that. Everything from, you know, being real crazy, assuming that we've been visited a zillion times, to, hey, it's all a hoax. So two questions there, Paul. Dust and UFOs and WS2N. WS2N to take it. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
I've never heard of problems with dust. The volcanoes they have in Hawaii, they're ongoing. I mean, they have every day it's creating new land. But I don't think it's creating a lot of smoke going up in the atmosphere. It's just a lot of lava coming out. Once on the mountains, it's very high. So whether or not it makes up that high into the atmosphere, I don't know. But I've never heard of a problem with that. You have a lot of clear nights. You really want clear nights all the time. You go down to Chile, the Atacama Desert, you're going to have almost 100% clear nights every night. As far as UFOs go, entertainment for me, but I'll watch anything to do with it. Whether or not, aliens have come here in the past, last 4,000 years, set up a base and told the Egyptians how to build the pyramids. It's a lot of fun to watch those shows, but I don't think so. Let me drop it. Aliens coming here and showing us how to build microchips, and we would have never had the integrated circuit. Now, if you read all the details about how the integrated circuit was developed step by step, you'll find out that we didn't need the aliens to do that. Whether or not they came here to propagate with us or they create more of themselves, I don't think they'd come all these light years to do that. Probably not. I don't think they'd be pulling us up to some spacecraft in the sky that we can't possibly detect, examining people and putting them back on Earth to wander around aimlessly without any thoughts, maybe not even remembering what happened. I don't think so. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm pretty much along with you on those, Paul. Also, when it comes to, what was it now, the teller, was it teller or one of the famous people 3 decades ago said the real paradox is how come we haven't been approached by them? And although it sounds like science fiction, the Prime Directive, I'm convinced there's a lot of merit in the Prime Directive, which basically is when you encounter another society that's very different than you in technological progress, the smartest thing you can do is do not interfere with them. Do not even reveal your presence, because there's a high probability that with their knowledge of your presence, you might destabilize them. Leave them alone. So I suspect that if we have been visited, there's a high probability that they have the equivalent of a Prime Directive, and there's a whole bunch of reasons I could give you for why that is likely. And therefore, the fact that they haven't made themselves equally easily known to us, assuming they're there, there's some merit in that. Alrighty. One last question there, Paul. You did answer the question as to how much material you're willing to volunteer for people who want to know space questions and they write to Paul, email him at spacenetreport@gmail.com. You'll be talking directly to Paul, WS2N, and your questions and or comments will be added to the TechNet on the coming weeks. I know that Wes has some questions now. N2XJN. Wes has a... Let me drop.
Glenn had a statement.
Yeah, sorry about that. Glenn, sorry, I forgot you. KC2QIQ. K2RHP. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, Dick, there isn't much time. Go right to Wesley. KC2QIQ.
I just tell us the subject you would have talked if we gave you the time. Go ahead, Glenn. Okay. Wes has a very ambitious project by my standards, and that is he has found a patent that was filed in 1956, and he is duplicating the hardware of that patent, which appears to have a technique of applying RF energy to some materials, and some desirable results take place to those materials when RF energy is applied to them, that the power is generated, and if all was well, it looks like it could be the possibility of cold fusion, a way of getting a lot of energy. By way of Pons and Fleischmann, all back 15, 20 years ago, where these two guys from the University of Utah thought they had found, by using palladium just right, a method of getting cold fusion. Ordinarily, a fusion nuclear reaction requires something in the vicinity of 10 million degrees centigrade temperature and something in the vicinity of 10 million atmospheres of pressure. You combine those two things just right and you have nuclear fusion. You get a tremendous amount of power, E equals mc squared, the Einstein equation, and that's what's been running the sun for the last 5 billion years, and it's going to run it for another 5 billion. Let me drop. So that's what real nuclear fusion is. And cold fusion are attempts to bypass those raw requirements. The 10 million degrees Fahrenheit and 10 million atmospheres, maybe it's only 1 million atmospheres, but some huge pressure and temperature combination where any material you and I would use to build that much pressure couldn't tolerate that temperature without melting. And anything that can build that temperature couldn't tolerate that pressure. It's a weird combination. In the middle of a star, like the sun, we have got a tremendous amount of material being pressed down with gravity. You can easily get that pressure and that temperature, and those stars are very happy to do that for you. It's 10 to the 22 power. You know, one with 22 zeros out there after it is the number of stars we get out there. It works very nicely if you got a lot of material. And other than that, to make a nuclear fusion reaction is extremely difficult. And so there are some fairly smart people saying that cold fusion is a nice dream, but I doubt it. And this project, one of the projects of Wes, is to duplicate this patented technique and to see if there's anything really there. And maybe that's one of the things Wes wants to talk about. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, so Jim, I have sent you the PDF about this spinning wheel, but I'm going to talk about energy. The old gentleman, older gentleman, was not able to pick up the rod with the bearing on the end of it and the wheel on it. But his colleague took the drill and spin up the wheel, and then with no problem whatsoever, he was able to pick up that and turn it around his head, which was, on my understanding, that you have a certain different of the spinning wheel, that is the amount of torque that you have to exert in order to change its direction, let me jump. And then torque is different from force, so the spinning wheel has a certain angular momentum pointing along the axis of the wheel. And that changes the magnitude of direction of angular momentum. But when we go to the gyroscope, we found the gyroscopic effect of the spinning is the basis of nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. You can spin the wheel inside the gyroscope and put it in any direction, and practically it will stay there, which then explain the precession in nuclear magnetic resonance. That would be that at any moment in time, I mean, we were talking about nuclear magnetic resonance, we're talking parallel and anti-parallel stages of the precession. At any moment in time, the top, if we take the regular top, is tilted from the vertical, but it does not fall. So we may ask ourselves the question, why? Because spinning object responds to the applied forces by moving their axis in direction perpendicular to the applied force, which then it has a pretty spectacular view for the viewer. And there is something that is being called quantum gyroscope. That is a very sensitive device to measure angular rotation based on quantum mechanical principles. But the basis for it is the magnetic field. At that point, we don't have to go for any cryogenic. We could use the magnetic field of the Earth. And there is something like a proton precession magnetometer, which uses the current flowing into selenoid that creates a strong magnetic field. Now, this is important because I have a coil, I have a transmitter, and I'm creating magnetic field. Around, say, it could be also a hydrogen, if we're talking about basic principles, rich fluid, could be kerosene or decaying or any popular solvent. And then that caused the protons to align themselves with the field and starting the precession. Another one is cesium vapor magnetometer, and cesium in L-137 is the radioactive substance. But coming to the nuclear magnetic resonance, people tend to forget about one thing that is very much present there and dangerous potentially to nuclear magnetic resonance patients. There is a friction between the nucleus and the surrounding electrons. The quadruple coupling contact is the term that is being used for it. So the effectiveness of this relaxation mechanism is critically dependent on the coupling. So when we're talking about the relaxation, we're talking about losing the spin and losing the speed. Of course, that's associated with Lamer precession, and I want to present Lamer precession in terms of electromagnetism, not in any other area. It's a common rotation superimposed upon the motion of the system of charged particles and having the same rotation of charge mass by magnetic field. So magnetic field could be one that is coming from the Earth, but magnetic field would be one that is created by the magnetic part of electromagnetic waves. Then there is something that is happening there. We could say that we have a sort of solvent there that makes the ionized molecules trap, and the free electron is converted then to neutral. But when we are trapping the orbit of the electron, then we create an energy, creating the photon. And we're coming right now to neutron activation, which I believe is important in what I'm doing. Neutron activation is a process in which neutron radiation induces radioactivity in materials and occurs when atomic nuclei capture free electrons, becoming heavier and entering excited stages. So the excited nucleon often decays immediately by emitting particles, such as neutron protons. No, we're talking about the protons. and alpha particles. In the forbidden transition that states that radio waves unlikely would be able to activate the compound and create unstable nuclei, that nuclei then will be able to produce anything of this sort, so say neutrons, and then that could be used by itself to create the electricity. One of the components of the compound, which is 100% non-radioactive, that I'm using is cobalt-59. But interesting fact is that cobalt-60 is not naturally occurring isotope, which I'm not using, and is formed from neutron activation of stable isotope cobalt-59. So a neutron collides with Co-59 nucleus and forms Co-60. So when cobalt-59 is bombarded by a neutron, then added neutron changes Co-59 to Co-60. And cobalt-60 has many uses. Of course, it is used as a radiation source for cancer treatment or for irradiated food or in manufacturing or many other ways. Now, what I'm trying to come to the point is that when I was leading an experiment with the Russian yolk, I have noticed the strange side effects which make a pain in my skull for a week after I came to U.S. And we didn't know at that time what is it that caused. I recall when I was a child, the parents told to the children, don't be close to the TV. Of course, Glenn would say that this is the X-ray that is created. To X-ray. So, then I came in here and with the help of another scientist, we assembled that tube, 100% non-radioactive. And we went to the activation of the compound using electromagnetic waves. And it looks like we have succeeded. Then two things happened in the meantime. There was a Russian guy who recently presented a device that used Russian yolk. And the video is online, so it's not a problem to see that video. Akua, and after the while, he disconnected the battery. He has two light bulbs of 250 watts, and he put the third one, 500 watts, on it. And the device works by itself. Of course, the ferrite is pretty much noisy, but it was noisy when I was in Lithuania, and subsequently we were able to extract 60 watts, 150 watts, 600 watts, and 1 kilowatt out of milliwatt input. At that time, I didn't know why the device... Andrea Rossi project is the project that uses only the thermal component of the same reaction as Coleman did, or as Lithuania experiment did, or Akua did, or TK. And what is happening? Okay. And the end of the story is this. Andrea wrote, of that was heard because the repeater was breaking up.
Yeah, we did have some interruptions at the end, Wes. Also, let me make one comment, and that is you have opened up about 7 separate subjects. That makes things a little bit complicated. The very first one I'm going to address first, and that is, you sent me a fairly nice YouTube video, which I think we could put on Bernie's website so other people could see it. And the main thing that was present in that particular YouTube video is that a man had what looked like, I'm going to call it a 20-pound weight that's usually used for late weightlifting, one of those 20-pound discs. He had it with a very precision bearing, ball bearing, mounted on the end of a rod. That rod looked to me like it was in the vicinity of a yard long, about a meter long yard. And he was holding the far end of the yard that didn't, the rod that didn't have, the end that didn't have the weight. To take the mass center of that weight and lift it with his one hand would be doable for a reasonable man of strength. To take the end of the rod that is 1 meter away from this 20-pound weight and lift it like a cantilever, nobody has a wrist that's strong enough to do that. Then what the man did was to use a drill motor. His friend used the drill motor to spin up the 20-pound weight. I'm calling it a 20-pound weight. He spun it up to a fairly high velocity, so it became a rather efficient gyroscope. Let me drop it. And when he had the gyroscopic action working, he then holds the end of the rod almost a yard, almost a meter away from the 20-pound weight. Because the gyroscopic action is making the yard act in a stiff manner, he was then able to take that end of the yard, rotate around his body, but lift it. He was able to lift the rod above his body while rotating it around his body. The rod stayed parallel to the ground, and he was able to lift it by the gyroscopic action. An exciting thing to watch, a beautiful proof of the way a gyroscope works and the way precession works. And a person who is a little bit naive might get the impression that the gyroscopic action and the action of this high-speed spinning weight was somehow canceling gravity and getting into magnetic resonance and other things. You could make speculations along those lines. To a person who has, let me drop it. To a person who has moderate understanding of how a gyroscope works, I mean, if I had a horizontal bar in front of me parallel to the ground and a bicycle wheel with its bearing is mounted in the middle of that rod, and if I spun the wheel at the at a reasonable velocity, and then if I tried to take the rod, the right-hand side down and the left-hand side up, my right hand is holding the right side, my left hand is holding the left side, and I tried to twist the bar so it's no longer parallel to the ground while the bicycle wheel, the top of the wheel, is spinning away from me, if I did that, the bar would attempt to rotate clockwise while I'm trying to push it down. Normal gyroscopic action, precession. A gyroscope almost always responds at right angles to the direction of the force you apply to its shaft. You try to push its shaft to the north and it moves to the east or to the west, depending on whether or not it's spinning clockwise or counterclockwise. Fairly normal precession gyroscopic action. And now, by some of the things you've said, Wes, maybe you're led to believe by some of the YouTube videos and other sources that you believe that action was somehow canceling gravity, making the 20-pound weight easier to lift, and doing something with reference to magnetic resonance. As you can tell, I'm a bit skeptical on that one.
John, would explain you?
Yeah, have I misunderstood that one? Am I explaining it the right way, John? And I think we could present that YouTube video for others to visit, to look at. It is an exciting thing to see, and it's a beautiful demonstration of a certain kind of physics. My first impression is no magic was taking place there, but maybe I missed something. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Six Man.
Dick, I know Wesley referred it to me, but I have no idea where he's going with this. He sent two videos, one with Levin and one with that older man. But I don't know where he's going with it. Let's find out. Back to you, Dick.
John, Dick doesn't believe the gyroscopic action that you see with the spinning wheel is something that is associated with nuclear magnetic resonance. Back to you.
Wes, the only direct evidence with nuclear magnetic resonance is the precession of the atomic structure in the electric field. which is basically the same thing. And you're looking at the spinning or the precession interfering with the magnetic coupling. That's what's happening in nuclear resonance. I don't understand your relationship with this.
Yeah, let me go back to John for a second now. John, if you did see the YouTube video that Wes mailed me, one of the early ones that he mailed me in last week, or maybe the beginning of this week, I'm not sure which has the man and the buddy with the drill motor spinning up the weight on a very precise bearing, and now he takes his rod and spins it around his body and raises it above his head with the rod always staying parallel to the earth. Possibly you've seen that YouTube video, and I think only gyroscopic action was taking place there. I don't think the nucleuses of those molecules, of those atoms, of any portion of that system, I don't think anything with reference to nuclear magnetic resonance takes place in normal gyroscopic action. To me, that was a beautiful demonstration of gyroscopic action. I wonder if your impression is different on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
No, Dick, no magic there. I believe that you do. That was a 40-pound weight, and it was spinning at 1,900 RPMs, I believe.
He seemed to be lifting the weight with a greater ease. In other words, it appeared as though, if I understand correctly, it appeared as though he had greater strength to lift it when it was spinning than it was not spinning. Did you get that impression, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
And that's the spectroscopy scientific material that I'm reading right now is related to self-spin, parallel state, and anti-parallel state of precession of nuclei. Enter it here.
Wesley, when you double, nobody can understand anybody. You've got to wait until it's passed over to you.
Oh, John, yeah, you might want to answer that question I just asked you.
Well, Dick, I saw that video, and when it was spinning, when he got it up to speed, you could see how easily he could hold it. Well, of course, but is that anti-gravity? Absolutely not. Gyroscopic action, or reaction if you want to call it that, and it's as simple as that. Now, Wesley's adding something else to it. He just made a comment, and I couldn't hear anything he was saying because it was a double.
Yeah, I'm going to get back to you on this one, John, and that is, let me stop for a second. The one mysterious part of the video is that when he lifted the 40-pound weight and bar near its mass center when it was not spinning, he made it look like it required almost the maximum muscle strength to lift it, like it was really heavy at 40 pounds. Yet when it was spinning and he held the end of the rod with the gyroscopic action, rotated it around his body and eventually brought it over his head, he made it look like it was lighter. And there I think he's creating a phony impression. The fact that he didn't say it, but he was implying by what you saw that it was somehow canceling gravity. And I was having a great deal of trouble bringing that a 40-pound weight spinning real fast would cancel gravity. But he did make it look that way. Did you get that impression also, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW, and the Tech Man.
In appearance, yes. But if you look at it, it doesn't happen because there's a second video of Levin doing it with a wheel. And you can see how he handles that wheel and how he can hang it on a hook. I don't know if you saw that video, but, you know, that explains what was going on there.
No, what I was trying, because the time is passing by. I'm not talking about anti-gravity. What I'm talking about is that this is the mechanism that is very much basic for nuclear magnetic resonance. And it is explained in the paper regarding gyroscopic effect in spinning wheel of nuclear magnetic resonance here, and that a bicycle wheel, as an example, is being used. If you want, I can send you the copy of it. So that applies to the spinning wheel, to the precession and in parallel and anti-parallel stage. So the material is definitely related.
Now let me ask you a question on this one, Wes. Are you saying that you believe there is very strong evidence that a spinning gyroscope, and a gyroscope that's undergoing precession, that a spinning gyroscope somehow has, with no other external magnetic field or electrostatic field, that the spinning gyroscope somehow has a magnetic resonance, nuclear magnetic resonance effect. Is that what you're saying? Because if so, there's a fair number of people that are going to have trouble accepting that. Is there a strong enough evidence of that? The fact that people believe it is not quite enough. Is there a nuclear magnetic resonance effect of a spinning gyroscope undergoing precession with no other local magnetic field? N2XJN, K2RIW.
It is not. It is just mechanical representation of what's going on over there. It is showing that when you go to the gyroscope and you put the spinning wheel on the horizontal position, and then you lift it on one side with your finger or with anything, it's going to stay in the same position. There's a representation explaining nuclear magnetic resonance in mechanical terms.
Okay, so that is a substitute demonstration of what nuclear magnetic resonance is and the way it is able to do imaging when there are hydrogen molecules in a substance in an NMR machine, is what I think you're saying. So the precession that takes place that changes the contrast of the materials being visualized, being viewed, being visualized, illustrated in an NMR machine, I think you're saying has a similarity with that spinning wheel experiment, is what I think you're saying. By the way, this was TechNet number 1447, and in about 2 minutes we're going to be cut off. Back to US K2RIW.
The important part of it, why I started from there and went to the experiment that I'm doing, is that people tend to forget that there is a friction between nucleus and surrounding electrons, and that is being called quadruple coupling constant. And whenever you have a friction, you have a reaction. And of course, then I went further to Lymer precession from electromagnetism, and then went to what happened to the free electrons in this process, and I went to neutron activation. And then, at the end of it, I went to the unstable nuclei, as this part is unstable nuclei. And I said also about potential danger to the patient, because if there is a friction, there is a heat associated with it. Let's explain.
VE3ZTZ info.
VE3ZTZ K2RIW. Go right ahead.
I just received within the last 2 or 3 weeks from my Scientific American news feed, there's a published paper on flywheels as a mechanism of storing solar or wind energy. And there's a gentleman who's done a phenomenal amount of work on flywheels and the imperfections in them to date. And it is not a manufacturing process. He has overcome some sort, it has something to do with quantum effect wobble. And he has somehow aligned that to get a flywheel that has the efficiencies that now rival and exceed chemical storage batteries, making it possible for wind turbines and solar energy to be captured in a flywheel and then played back into the network when the solar or the wind is stopped. Now, it talks about all of the things that you're talking about, and it is breakthrough, and there was an article in Scientific American on it within the last 3 weeks. You might want to try and look it up. I've tried to go backwards while I've been listening to this, and I haven't been able to find it yet, but I'm looking. V3ZTZ.